to Cooler Than Homework, a Disney Channel original movie podcast. I'm Nicole Sweeney, and the farthest I have ever traveled was LA to Shanghai.
Ooh. I feel like as a non-traveler, I am going to be very boring. I am Matthew Gatos, and the furthest I've ever traveled in my life, I'm pretty sure, was when I was 10. Me and my mom went on a cruise to the Bahamas.
My name is Marines, and the furthest I have ever traveled, or I guess the furthest I've been away from home from Fort Lauderdale, is Turkey.
And I'm Sari, and the farthest I've ever traveled, even though I don't remember it, is New Jersey to Malaysia when I was like one. So there are video proof of me being there, but
your body traveled that distance, so
yeah,
it counts. This week we are talking about The Color of Friendship, which is not actually about the farthest you've ever traveled, but it does feature a character traveling very far from home. But Mari, what's the plot of this movie?
The Color of Friendship is all about making Mari cry. It is based on true events, and it is about the Dellums family. So the dad, Ron Dellums, is a congressman from California living in D.C., and this movie takes place in 1977. So his 13-year-old daughter, Piper, wants the family to host as an exchange student from Africa. And after some consideration, Ron agrees that it would be a good educational opportunity for their family. Meanwhile, we meet the Bach family in Dundee, South Africa. Mari is similarly trying to get permission from her parents to go to America for the exchange program. We get a sense of Mari's life there. Her father is a policeman, and right when we meet them, he happily brings the family news that the South African government has caught and arrested Stephen Biko. The Bach family also keeps a black maid named Flora, who thinks it will be good for Mari to spend time in America. Mari also has a little brother, and in one of these establishing scenes, he captures a weaver bird, and Flora tells us the story of this bird, this weaver bird, that nests in community, and they all work together. Mari gets paired with the Dellums family, and all that she knows is that she's going to be staying with a congressman in D.C., so she assumes that she will be staying with a white family, and all the Dellums know is that they're getting a South African student, so they assume that they're getting a black student. When she arrives and meets Piper and the mom, Roscoe, she assumes that they're the help, and doesn't understand that she's staying with a black family until she's taken to meet Congressman Dellum, who is in a meeting with a bunch of other black congressmen. So Mari is shook. Once they are back at the Dellums' house, Mari locks herself up in Piper's room and refuses to come out. That night, she does sneak out and calls her parents, presumably to tell them that she needs to GTFO. But her father has been teasing her about how he knew she wouldn't last more than a week, and she would be begging to come home. So after he teases her some more, Mari decides that she's going to stay. Piper eventually picks the lock into her own room to bring Mari something to eat. She's also really sassy about how rude Mari is being. So Mari seems to realize this, and she asks Roscoe if it would be okay for her to stay with the Dellums. Roscoe says, of course it's okay. During her stay, Mari grows closer with Piper and the family, seeing and realizing a lot of the things that are different for them in the U.S., including malls where people of all races and ethnicities shop together, and the school she attends with Piper, which is a mixed race school, and all of the music and movies and books that are banned in South Africa that she can read in the U.S. Things are going well until Stephen Biko dies under mysterious circumstances in South Africa. Protests break out in the U.S., and the South African embassy decides to remove Mari from the Dellums family and keep her in the embassy until they can get her home. While Piper is having sad about the fact that Mari was removed, her Nigerian friend comes over to challenge her view of Mari as like a genuine friend. Mari, for instance, could never invite Piper to South Africa, and it was the police, which Mari's dad is a policeman, who killed Stephen Biko. Congressman Dellums learns that Mari has been taken and he goes to the South African embassy to get her back. I cheered, y'all, when he walked into the embassy. I'm not going to lie. he threatens the embassy with like media coverage of, you know, embassy kidnaps exchange student. And that gets them to agree to release her. And back at the Dellums house, though, Piper's still in her feelings about that reality check that her Nigerian friend gave her. So when Mari makes a dismissive comment about Biko's death, Piper is outraged and she yells at Mari for having no idea about the racial struggle in South Africa, and she calls the police pigs. So Mari is obviously very hurt by this. She runs out of the house. Ron and Roscoe both hear all of this, and Ron goes outside to talk to Mari. Mari cries because she could never invite Piper to stay with her, and it's not only because of the government, but because of her family and her neighbors. Ron says that governments have a lot to do with the way that people think, and America has had a long, hard history of trying to overcome problems of inequality, and South Africa is going through that now. Mari cries over the state of her government and the uselessness she feels in the face of that, and, you know, I felt that as well.
The mood.
the big mood. Ron assures her that you can make a difference. Piper joins them, and she kind of silently apologizes, and Mari shares with both of them the story of the Weaver Bird. And from there, we cut to a Pan-African festival that Ron helped organize. He delivers a speech about freedom and equality and shares with everyone the story he just learned from Mari about the Weaver Bird. Finally, it's time to say our emotional goodbyes to Mari. And when she's home, Mari greets Flora with a big hug and shows her that she's got a freedom fighter flag sewn into the inside of her jacket. And the last shot is of Mari releasing the Weaver Bird back into the wild. The end.
Matt, it is now time for you to tell us where the cast of this movie is now.
All right. So I did sort of an abbreviated one because I feel like, I don't know, personally, I feel like in the past few movies I've done too long of a segment. So I'm going to abbreviate it a bit. It also helps that not a lot of this cast has done much. So thanks, guys. I'm going to lead off here with Melanie Nichols King, who played Flora, the maid of the Bach family. After The Color of Friendship, she went on to be in the famous Jet Jackson, The Wire, Orphan Black. But more recently, she was on both Star Trek Discovery and Anne with an E. So she's still acting in a lot of different things. And she's one of those people you just sort of recognize as like, oh, yeah, she was in that episode. Lindsay Hahn, who plays Mari Bach in this, is still acting in a lot of things. Closer to the time of The Color of Friendship, she became a Disney Channel movie surfer, which is where I think I recognized her mostly from. I'm assuming, Nicole and Mari, you were aware of the movie surfers, but Sari was not.
I forgot that this was a thing. I just had this moment of like you saying those words and being like, oh, wow. Wow.
Same. So, yeah. Yes. And then I was like, I don't know what that is. But then when you're like, you should know what that is, my brain was kind of like, come on, you know what that is.
yeah.
But that was the entire process just now.
What is it?
It's so on the Disney Channel, between like in commercial breaks or between episodes of things, they would have these little segments called Disney Channel Movie Surfers. And it was basically like a bunch of teens taking you behind the scenes of the latest Disney movie or whatever. And there was sort of just like this regular cast of kids who were doing it. I remember that the sort of like popular girl from Xenon, she became one of the movie surfers as well. Mm-hmm. But Lindsay Hahn, who played Mari, also became one of those movie surfers. So there's lots of those clips on YouTube of her being very excited about The Incredibles or other Disney movies that were coming out during that time.
Gotcha. When you first said Disney Channel movie surfers, I thought they were like a reoccurring cast member, like appeared in future Disney Channel movies, but you were trying to hide that from me because you couldn't say the titles. And so you just came up with this cool name.
No, it's more that like watching the Disney Channel, there were commercials, but I feel like the commercial breaks on the Disney Channel featured like maybe two actual commercials, and then the rest of the commercial breaks were commercials for other Disney things. It was a like wild self-contained ecosystem.
Yeah, it was like, here, watch this behind the scenes of a movie that you're gonna ask your parents to go see. Oh, but then wait, here, watch this mini concert of NSYNC performing at Walt Disney World.
This is so bizarre, because I guess this is why I didn't have any Disney news, because Disney only advertised on its own channel.
Yes!
So there's no way of me to get anything, know anything that was going on.
Yeah, this is before they owned everything else. Mm-hmm. So they only had their own network to to reach out to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to be a kid nowadays where you could hear Let It Go anywhere in the world.
What a time to be alive. But Lindsay Hahn also kept acting after being in The Color of Friendship, beyond being a movie surfer. She actually most recently played Sia's mom in the music video for Move Your Body, which is a music video that's sort of like set in the 80s. Sia's like a kid in it trying to break free from her parents. And so Lindsay Hahn is in that playing Sia's mother in very like mom jeans and big hair and all this stuff. She also played Hadley Hale, who is Suki's cousin on True Blood, which I have never watched True Blood. So apologies to those people who maybe are like, of course she played Hadley Hale. Everyone knows that. But it seems like she is more interested in directing these days than acting. She recently directed a film that is in post-production called Hanky Panky that is about a man and his sentient napkin saving the world. So
wow,
look out for that one. Streaming soon, probably. I don't know.
It's a good title, though, for that like very specific thing.
I thought the same thing. I saw the title and was like, what's this about? And I was like, oh, that's pretty clever. I like it.
Yeah. I don't know what else you'd call it. Like super napkin, but that's not cool.
And like a lot of people that I've talked about on this podcast, she has a nice, very normal Instagram, which is always just great to see because, you know, that it seems like she's having a good life, which is really the best outcome for all DCOM stars. Moving on to Shadia Simmons, who plays Piper Dellums in this. She went on to act in a couple of other things, but not a ton beyond the early to mid 2000s. But this won't be the last time we'll be watching one of her movies on this podcast. Won't spoil what else she's going to be in, but we'll see her again. She is now a high school teacher who has also started an acting school outside of Toronto, Canada. So if you're looking for acting lessons or coaching outside of Toronto, Canada, hit up Piper, I guess. Now we come to, like a lot of these movies, the most famous people in the cast are the parents. And playing the mom in this, Roscoe Dellums, is Penny Johnson, who you might know from The Larry Sanders Show or ER or Star Trek Deep Space Nine. But since The Color of Friendship, she's gone on to be a regular on 24, Castle, The Orville. And she's also the voice of Nala's mom, Serafina, in the new, quote, live action Lion King movie.
I hate it. It annoys me so much. Like it is my irrational pet peeve, calling them live action. I recognize how ridiculous it is for me to be as annoyed as I am, because they just announced the Bambi one or whatever. And again, I'm like, it's not gonna be fucking live action. Stop calling it that. Please stop calling it that.
Yeah, if there's not any humans in it and you didn't shoot it anywhere in the real world, it's not a live action movie.
It's not a live action movie. You can't cast a fucking real life lion as Simba.
That'd be much more interesting though if they tried to actually shoot that with like a bunch of lions and meerkats and toucans all in the same room at the same time. And they're like, I don't know, we gotta try and make it live action because that's what we called it. And last but certainly not least, we have Carl Lumbly as Congressman Ron Dellums. If you're older than those of us who host this podcast, you might recognize him from the 80s show Cagney and Lacey. I did not. I've heard of that show, referenced on other shows mostly, but did not know he was in that.
I know about that as a thing that existed.
Yeah, pretty much. I've heard people like use those names together. Like, Cagney and Lacey. And I'm like, yeah. But I recognized him from an episode of The West Wing that he's in. And more recently, from playing Dick Halloran in Dr. Sleep, the sequel to The Shining, which was one of those moments where I'm like watching this movie and just going, I know this man. Who is this man? And then looking it up and I was like, oh, I just saw him in a movie like 6 months ago. That makes sense.
Watching these movies with Sylvia, every time she's like, I know this person, we look at their IMDb, or she looks at their IMDb, they're always Grey's Anatomy. And it's the funniest thing in the world. Even it's always like Grey's Anatomy, one episode. And then she's like, oh, this is the weird injury they suffered.
Devin is the exact same way with Parks and Rec. There are a lot of times people pop up in this and she's like, who is that? And I look it up and it's, sure enough, they played some weird townsperson in Parks and Rec that she also knows the entire story of their character.
Incredible.
But yes, this man has been in a bunch of other things. He's like a regular on Supergirl. He's on NCIS Los Angeles. He was on Alias. And he's also done a bunch of voiceover work. Most famously, he is the voice of Martian Manhunter in the Justice League cartoon from the mid-2000s. But yeah, that is it for all of the cast I chose to talk about this time.
Matt, you left out the most important, where are they now? For me, personally, emotionally, in my heart.
I legit cannot wait to hear who.
And this is the random little white boy friend of the brothers, Billy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Billy?
Yes. He's played by Ryan Cooley, who was JT York on Degrassi, The Next Generation. Very important to me that we acknowledge that we not participate in this JT York erasure. That's all. I just had to put that out there.
As a non-Degrassi fan, I was not aware of his level of significance, and I apologize.
He's very important. They killed him off because the actor wanted to, like, go to school and, you know, not be acting anymore, I guess. I don't know. And that was, like, when I stopped watching the show, is when JT York gets murdered. I was like, no, I cannot. I'm done now. So he's very important to me.
I did just find out through quick Googling while you're talking about him that he does apparently play his own ghost in an episode of Degrassi at a later time. So
wow.
So if you didn't stick around, you didn't get to see him come back and play JT's ghost.
I should watch Ghost of Degrassi Past. That sounds like an episode that I'm really interested in. That's the content that I want.
Yeah, find and watch immediately.
All right, so now it is time for us to talk about The Color of Friendship. So first of all, nostalgia check. Do you remember watching this movie prior to watching it for this podcast?
I do not.
I did, to the part where they were sitting in an ice cream parlor and, like, I don't know, they came out to sing like a happy birthday song. And as soon as it started, I was like, oh no, so here's a gift to show our love. Like, I knew the whole thing. I was like, damn, I watched this a lot. So yes, I watched it a lot.
I also watched this one a lot. This is probably the first one in a while that I was super excited for Sari to do her plot guest, solely because I was like, I remember this one really well. Like, I know very vividly the whole plot of this movie rather than just like a vague sense of the thing. So yes, I watched this one a ton.
And to no one's surprise, no, but I wish I had. Like, this would have been a really good movie for young Sari to watch.
Alas, young Sari did not know about the Disney Channel.
Alas, yeah, Disney did not advertise outside of Disney.
All right, so did you guys like this movie?
I mean, spoiler alert, we talked a little bit before we started recording, and I think we all really, really enjoyed it.
Yes. The pre-recording conversation was us talking about putting this on our ranking sheet and how it feels like we can't rank it against the other movies. Like, how?
Yeah, it needs like a separate sheet, like in that doc, mm-hmm. like just like all the other movies. And then, of course, over here on its own sheet, not being tainted by these other films, is The Color of Friendship.
I did do exactly that. All of my movies are ranked in column A of my little tab on the spreadsheet. And I've dragged The Color of Friendship over to column B.
I see that on the master sheet, you've included an interrobang next to its ranking.
As if to say, say, why is this here?
Amazing.
So I mentioned that I watched this a lot, and this was one of the ones that I was like, damn, I really enjoyed this when I was a kid. I hope it holds up. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that fear of like, I hope it holds up too, is that obviously it's talking very candidly and very openly about race and racism. So I was like, I don't know, like, could this movie from 2000, 20 years later, almost exactly, like, how will that all hold up, the messaging and all of that? And I watched this last night and I cried in my bed, man, cried in the club over this movie. I think that it holds up surprisingly well, but also, I don't know, it just, there were, you know, from a movie sense of it, a lot of like the storytelling and the family. I love that, mm-hmm. The Dellums family so much. I love the dad so much. So there were so many pieces of it that were like, that gave me emotions, but just from like the storytelling aspect of it. So I really enjoyed this. And I agree that you almost can't compare it to the other movies, the other DCOMs we've watched. I don't know. It's weird because I feel like it is better, but it's different too, because it is not like a fun skating movie or a fun surfing movie, you know, but it is in and of itself just like also a really good movie.
I was also afraid of that. Like, will it hold up? Because yes, like this is, I think of all of the movies that I remember loving, this is precisely the kind of thing that has the most potential to not, because it's one of the few that's really, really saying something, you know,
right.
Like, and so I like all of, generally speaking, these movies all have some sort of, you know, moralizing message. Like that's kind of the nature of, you know, Disney making stuff for children. This one had a political message, which is less common. And so that's totally the kind of thing that 20 years time could maybe make not hold up. I was somewhat optimistic because this is the first DCOM to win an Emmy for Outstanding Children's Program. But even so, like, I don't know, Emmy voters 20 years ago, like that's still, I wasn't comforted until I actually watched it. I wasn't sure.
Going into this, I was aware of sort of like the topics it covered, but I was definitely not prepared for sort of the depth with which it covered those topics.
Yes.
And I didn't expect it to be so candid and like honest about these things. I expected sort of like the Disney twist on racism, and it definitely was much better at presenting that stuff than I ever thought it could be.
Mm-hmm. And I think the point about the like storytelling beats and stuff too, it probably the most surprising thing to see how well that stuff held up. Like the, even just listening to your plot synopsis, Mari, like the ways in which they seeded all of the details, they were thoughtful. All of the stuff was there, but it was also done in a way that I felt like it was really respecting its child audiences, you know, like it wasn't super repetitive or super overdone. Like when they introduce, I've already forgotten his name, but the activist who dies in custody, like that moment felt mostly like we were establishing the groundwork that this white South African family is very pro-apartheid and getting that out there. But like also it was actually seeding this like larger kind of narrative thread. I just, getting to this point now in the watching movies for this podcast, I am struck by not only all of the ways in which this movie thoughtfully and like directly handled the issues that it wanted to tackle, but also the ways in which it was respectful of its child audience, you know, that like it didn't talk down to them, that it like trusted them to pick up on the threads.
To that point, I feel like it is a movie that different audiences would get something different out of. Like everyone would get something out of, but it did a really good job of providing enough context. So if this is like a child's first experience with hearing about apartheid and everything that happened, like this is a good history lesson. And this is a good way, like through the character of Mari, discovering what's happening in South Africa or what happened in South Africa and like the political situation in, or a very small slice of the political situation in America as well. And I think even just from like having child characters, it provides the lens for the audience to come in completely blind, like as a child would, and learn all these things. But if you know something about the history, then you get something else out of it, and like seeing how different folks are reacting. Or if you, I don't know, like lived through it, I'm sure that would give you another perspective on it. You could compare how they portrayed these events in the movie to protests or other reactions that were happening in your life, in your area, or what you heard in the news, because they highlight the idea of really biased perspectives so well, where by bringing these two opposite characters and opposite families together, you can see how racism good, racism bad perspectives, and you can see sort of where your inherent biases and where your take on the situation fit into that very stark spectrum that the movie presented. And so I just think it's so thoughtful, and it's really thought-provoking for a viewer too, in all the ways that it's set up these conflicts between these characters.
Even as I started watching, I still had, like, I was a little bit hesitant that it would fall too heavy on one side of, like, it could go very pro-America, which was kind of what I was thinking it was going to do. But it did also, I thought it was interesting the way that it was trying to look at, like, the situation in the U.S. at that time, but also honestly and say, like, there's still a lot of ways to go. They drove through a less good part of DC and kind of had that conversation as well. And then I thought, well, it could be, would it, is this going to be like to like humanize the racist? But I thought that it avoided that as well. Probably a portion of that is making the main character a child. Mm-hmm. And so very much a product of her environment and her government and whatnot. But it did a good job of like navigating what Sari was saying. Like, you know, it's the systems, it's the racism that you kind of are fighting against or whatnot. So it just, I don't know, it did a really good honest job of tackling this. And I just think that it was a very interesting, like, cross section of time and history and place to look at, like, racism, because it is history that is related to what we know, which is U.S. history, but not exactly ours. But it is like a congressman that really lived and, you know, based on his story and his family story. So it was just a really, like I said, interesting, just like intersection of all of these, like, little things that you are familiar with, but showing you something that you might not be, and then how having all of that be the commentary on what it wanted to say about race.
Sort of related to that, I liked how the movie addressed the fact that she was a child really head on and was aware that it was using that as part of its storytelling, because I, as a 25-year-old viewer of this who is aware of racism, was deeply uncomfortable when Mari was making assumptions about the Dellums family being the help. But the way in which Roscoe specifically, I loved her character the most. I like wanted to be best friends with her. She kept reminding her family that Mari was just a child and is a product of those systems, and that she can change her mind. She is still young. She is still accepting a lot of the beliefs that are told to her. And I think hearing that explicitly is really powerful for a child watching the movie, or like anyone watching the movie, to recontextualize, like, children are the products of their environment, and they can change and they can grow, and they will grow before they become a fully formed adult.
At the risk of being super repetitive, just reiterating the things that have already been said. But I firmly agree with all of that. And I just think, like, the dynamic with the whole Dellums family in terms of how they handled, like, and reacted to the racism, like, was really, really interesting. And the fact that you had that spectrum, and yes, I agree, like, watching Roscoe be like the mother, but also be, you know, like, frustrated, you know, like that bit at the breakfast table, like, she's clearly frustrated, but she's thinking it through. She's like, okay, how do, like, what is the correct way for me as a parental figure in this scenario to, like, navigate this, and, like, how do I counter this, and whatever. But then you also have, shortly before that breakfast scene, the bit with Piper. You know, we also see her kind of trying to teach her, like, actual daughter something through this. And Piper is like, well, okay, like I get that she's like a kid or whatever, she's 14, but like I'm only 13 and I can look at this and see that this is bullshit. So like, you know, I like watching that dynamic and watching all of them kind of navigate that in slightly different ways was really like just good and well done.
I think it also had like Roscoe is the one that's, you know, she was being the peacemaker and navigating both sides of it. And it was good of the movie to also remind us that the Dellums family made an assumption as well. And they were expecting this like black South African student. And so they had to check their assumptions. And probably it was easier for them coming from their experience or whatnot. But she was like, okay, just a reminder, we all did this, which I thought was neat. But and I loved Roscoe as well. But I think that I already mentioned this with the dad, Ron. I don't know why I just all of my feelings went out to this character so much, and he had so many scenes that I like legitimately just had so many feelings about when they have the discussion over like the different words that South Africans were using to describe black people, and so they come across the one that is more like the N-word or whatnot, and so Mari is just so offhandedly like, yeah, these are the words that we use, that even seeing that I was like, oh my god, you know, like Sarah said, deeply uncomfortable about this mm-hmm. whole thing. But then when Piper is telling her parents about it and they think that Mari has called her this word and they both like jump up in arms, like the surge of like family feelings and of like dad to the rescue and oh hell no you didn't, like all of that come together. I don't know, I thought that was like a really cool, powerful scene, not only from like what it was saying again about the race stuff, but just like from the aspect of like, what did you call my daughter? And then again when he went to the embassy, and when Mari is like, Mr. Dellums, and he's like, I got this. I was like, yes, yes, this is so good.
I also just really like too the fact that, I mean, obviously it's based on a true story, but like we have on the one hand Roscoe being the one who was like, no, this is a child, and like I am gonna like, you know, put in the work to try to undo whatever, like I'm going to be as understanding as I can be because she's a child, whatever, but like because this is also so much of the dad's like life's work, you know, like they never framed his struggle with that in a way that felt unfair, you know, like it was like, yeah, like I get it, like I get how you are really fucking uncomfortable with like hosting the child of a South African cop, like that's valid, that's a real and legitimate like concern and thing for you to be feeling right now.
I also think this movie did something really well with the dad that a lot of DCOMs and sitcoms of the 90s and 2000s didn't do, and that was being able to show like busy parents while not making them seem like inherently bad parents because they are busy. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie shows that like he is super busy. For one scene, he like doesn't answer the phone for half a day because he's so busy. But never does this movie make me feel like he's a bad person for doing that. Mm-hmm. Like it shows that like his work is important and what he is doing is important, but it also shows him caring for his family enough and doing things for his family and the people around him enough that we don't ever feel like he's sacrificing like one for the other. And I think it's a really easy trope for a lot of these eras, like pieces of media, to fall into of just like the busy dad who has no time for family, like Johnny Tsunami's dad.
Mm-hmm. Sort of related also to tropes and acknowledging that the story was based off of real people. I loved the way the little brothers were written in that they were just great. They made me laugh out loud, like genuinely. That's the only note I took the whole movie was at some point they said maybe her family wanted to get rid of her and they finally got the chance. And I like cackled at that. Yeah. It's like, of course, that's such like a snotty little brother thing to say if you're uncomfortable with a situation or like this girl's being rude to your family. And so I think they did a really good job like filling that role in the family of having little siblings, but also adding a different perspective on the situation and like working in genuine comic relief, because that is what little children do. They just say things without thinking of consequences.
And they also like weren't disruptive to the plot or the characters around them, which I feel like is another thing that, like, that one kid from Up, Up and Away was supposed to be sort of the comic relief, but he was just kind of obnoxious and did weird things to try and get laughs. But these two felt like they were naturally a part of the story and just kind of had their own little side thing going on where they were cracking jokes and making each other laugh.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Up, Up and Away. So just like the 1-2 punch that Disney did of black superhero family, also a very good family like unit. And then bam, Color of Friendship, another amazing black family. And just like tackling this. I don't know what was going on at Disney at this point, but whoever made that 1-2 happen, good on you.
This week, in honor of this actually very good movie that was actually very thoughtful about its lessons, we are discussing other media that like genuinely taught us something, that had a like real point of view that we feel like we learned something from. So I guess that was not really framed as a question, which means that I will go first. So the first thing that came to mind for me was Number of the Stars by Lois Lowry, which we read in class at some point in elementary school, but I read it on my own. I bought it at the Scholastic Book Fair when I was in first grade, or rather my mom bought it for me after I picked it out at the all-important Scholastic Book Fair when I was in first grade. That and a biography of Jackie Joyner Kersee, the Olympic runner. So I don't know. Those were my interests at 7. But and I bought this book mostly because the little girl on the cover looked like me. So that's like, that was my logic at 7 years old. It's set during the Holocaust, and it is about the escape of a Jewish family from Denmark during World War II. And so the little girl on the cover who looks like me, she is the friend of a Jewish girl whose family is like trying to escape, and like her and her family helps them escape, basically hides them and then helps them escape. And so I'm pretty sure that this was my first exposure to the Holocaust as a concept. It was an incredibly formative reading experience for me. It is the first book that I know for a fact made me cry. And it is a book that I read a bunch as a little kid. It was like a book that I kept returning to because it moved me. But also I was a kid, and so I didn't entirely understand, like, I just had so little access to media that affected me in the way that this book did. And so it was this thing that I kept returning to specifically for that reason. And I think, I don't know, like, it just profoundly moved me as a small child in a way that I still remember quite vividly now as an adult.
Sort of related to this, you talking about that book made me think of Persepolis, the graphic novel, which what I think I read in when I was in 7th or 8th grade, so like very beginning of being a teenager. And it's an autobiographic graphic novel by Marjane Satrapi, I think, that depicts her life in Iran during and like slightly after, I think, the Islamic Revolution. So a lot of similar, like, how she survived through political and social strife and like what her experience was like. And that was one of the first times that I grew up reading a lot of comics, Donald Duck comics and Calvin and Hobbes. And then as I got older, I started reading more graphic novels. And this is one of the first like historical graphic novels that really gripped me, where I felt like, I don't know, I love comics and I love graphic novels as a medium, but I like forgot that I was learning through it. Like, it was such an intense story. I remember it really affecting me. And I think I did a book report or something on it in school and was like, hello, welcome to learning about the Islamic Revolution through pictures. Whereas other kids in my class chose other books. I was like, here, we're going to learn about history. And it was the first of like many graphic novels that I started reading about historical events like Mouse, which also about the Holocaust. And I don't know, I wish I had more intelligent things to say about it, but I've only been thinking about it as an answer to this prompt for like a couple minutes. But it also really affected like the way that I thought about how what kinds of stories you could tell with graphic novels and how to make historically resonant stories that are relevant to how we understand our world today, widely accessible to more people.
I also think to this point about like not being able to think of a more eloquent way to like to talk about it. To me, part of why I struggle with that is that it is something that is so deeply rooted in like a formative experience that like my inability to come up with a more eloquent thing to say about it and the experience itself, like those two things are actually kind of one in the same, like they go together, because the reason that this is my answer to this prompt is so rooted in like, I read this when I was 7 years old and like, it feels like it affected so much of the way that I read afterwards, you know, like in a way that is nearly impossible to articulate because it came to me before I had the kind of language that I now have about the media that I consume.
I'm going to expose myself as a child non-reader here, unfortunately, because I didn't read a lot. I still don't read a lot, to be fair, but I definitely was not unfortunately, I was not super encouraged to read as a kid. So I watched a lot of TV, and this is probably not going to sound, I don't know, thinking on my choice now, it doesn't sound as deep necessarily, but it falls into the same category of hard to describe what it meant to me as a kid. And especially once you hear what it is, it's going to sound wild that is how I describe it, because it's the TV series Roseanne. Yeah, there's a few reasons I think that this resonated with me so much as a kid and still now looking back. If you ignore who Roseanne is as a person now these days and just look back at 90s Roseanne, part of this is that growing up, my mom and dad are quite similar to Dan and Roseanne on that show, like in stature, in sarcastic sense of humor, in a lot of ways. Like if you've met my parents, Dan and Roseanne, pretty much my parents. But no offense to my parents, throwing them under the bus here a little bit. They were never very talkative about important issues. They never like sat me down for like the talk about anything, whether it be sex or anything else. Like I never really got those moments. And so a lot of those types of things I learned about from watching TV shows. And Roseanne was one of those shows that I was watching at like 6, 7, 8 years old and learning about things like racism and sex and queer people and domestic abuse, poverty and birth control. And like they have a lot of those episodes and they handle them in very like honest, straightforward ways that exposed me as a kid to things that I wasn't being exposed to by like from conversations at home or from books I was reading or anything. So it was not something I necessarily realized when it was happening, but looking back as I got into like my teen years and 20s, and people would talk about how their parents talked to them about certain issues or how like they learned about certain things, a lot of my memories end up going back to not just episodes of Roseanne, but like episodes of other TV shows or movies and things that tackled a lot of these issues. And so that sort of like stereotypical raised by TV is me, apparently, because it was like that's if you know me in person, most of my references are from 90s TV shows. And that's a lot of this is because that was sort of my education on a lot of societal things growing up. So it was probably, very helpful for me to see there's an episode where DJ is unsure about kissing the girl who's playing Juliet in the Romeo and Juliet play. And it's not because she's a girl, it's because she's black. And his family has to sit him down and tell him why, like, he should not be feeling this way and why, like, where that racism is coming from. And then they have episodes where I'm pretty sure they had the first gay marriage on like a national sitcom. And so these things were important to me as a kid to see and be exposed to when my parents weren't necessarily doing the talking about those things. That was a great last sentence to end on, but there you go.
I think that's really interesting because like, I don't know, there are so many counter arguments to like representation in media doesn't matter. But like, this is just one more to add to the pile of like,
proof.
Sitcoms about families being families in diverse ways and running into situations and living their lives are important. And like, the more situations that you can show on TV, there is probably a kid out there watching it for the first time and figuring something out about the world. I just love media. Everyone should watch TV and movies and stuff and like learn about the world, learn about experiences that aren't their own.
Wow.
Anyway. Wow.
It's funny because after Nicole and Sari gave their answers, I was like, oh no, I took mine in a different direction. And then Matt gave his like, you know, he led up to his answer. I was like, oh no, is he going to steal my answer? Yeah, they're different. There are a lot of directions that you could go with this, like, you know, things that we read in school, nonfiction. I was even thinking about like Judy Blume books when I was a preteen, you know, teaching about like what Matt said, you never get sit down for the talk, but you know, a Judy Blume book taught you what a period was and things like that. But The real thing that jumped out, and this is going to sound like I'm joking maybe, but I'm not at all trying to be facetious about this at all, but I thought about the old Rugrats episodes that focused on like Jewish holidays like Hanukkah and Passover.
Oh, when I first thought of my answer to this as being Number of the Stars, like that was also one of the first things that came to mind, because I was trying to think like how, like what did I know prior to reading this book? Like what are the things that I knew? And like, I don't know, like I went to a school that had a like significant Jewish population, so like we got holidays and stuff, but I feel like even my knowledge of Jewish holidays probably mostly came from Rugrats.
To this day, something like gets brought up and I'm like, yeah, I learned that through the Rugrats. And the fact that that is like, you know, has stuck with me. And obviously it has like a humorous twist and there are things that they change about like the story in order to fit the fact that babies are telling the story. But, you know, growing up in a Christian household, like I was shook. I had no idea. Like it's what Sari is saying about how like media can expose you to things that, you know, are different from your own worldview or your own experience. So the Rugrats taught me about the Jewish holidays. And honestly, to this day, if somebody mentions like the Maccabees or something, I'm like, yeah, I watched that on Rugrats.
Tommy Pickles taught me. But like, and they did it in such a like accessible way to kids. I don't know, like there's, I guess it's been such a long time since I've watched it, but I feel like it is a testament to something done well that I also still have those associations very strongly.
No, as someone who has watched it far more recently, unsurprisingly, I can tell you that the Rugrats Passover episode still holds up. It's very good, and it does handle it in like a straightforward way. It doesn't do what I feel like a lot of, again, 90s, early 2000s sort of media did, where like anything that wasn't like a white Christian lifestyle was like, whoa, that's weird, would you tell me about it? And like this just handled it very much in a direct way of like his parents sit down and they're his grandparents sit down and they're like, how do you not know the story of Passover? We have to share the story of Passover with you. It's so important. And you're like, oh yeah, and I believe you, I trust you, it's an important story, please teach me.
I am now in my feels like, can we just do a whole podcast episode about media that shaped us? Because now I have like, my list goes on. I was like, I want to talk about the magic school bus and how it inspired me to do science because they went inside Arnold's body. And I was like, that's so weird and cool. Or like Blue's Clues. I loved scavenger hunts, and it's probably because I watched those dang paw prints be placed around the house in Blue's Clues and solving puzzles. And it's like my whole childhood, my whole current self is shaped by the media I watched. And in this TED Talk, I will.
I also totally thought, Sari, that you were going to say we should do an entire episode about Rugrats.
Same.
And I was like, yes,
please. I was like, yeah, great. I'm ready.
Because, I mean, yeah, again, that's another show where, like, not only, like, outside of the Passover episode, but, like, that's a show that had, like, storylines about adoption and single parents and stay-at-home dads and, like, a lot of things that people were not dealing with on other kids' shows.
To some of the things that we said about like this movie, it did those things in a way that felt just like really kind to the children who were watching it.
This is no longer a DCOM podcast. We're now watching and we're talking about every episode of the Rugrats sequentially.
If you want that podcast to happen, join our Patreon. We'd be happy to make it for you.
Yeah, it'll be our special podcast called Smugrats, where we tell you why Rugrats is better than every other show.
And now it is time for us to share the lessons that we learned from this movie that was a very lesson-heavy movie. I learned about that cool bird. That's it. That bird was really cool. That was one of the few things about this movie that I didn't remember from watching it over and over when I was younger. But the bird story was really great.
On that note, the lesson I learned is that if you've been gone for 4 months and you come home, you should probably tell your brother before you're going to free his pet bird.
I learned that there are some movies that make you do a deep dive on Wikipedia and Google about things, and I totally did a deep dive after this movie on Ron Dellums and just the story, which was based on a short story, and what actually happened to the real Mari. Her name wasn't Mari and all that, but it's, you know, I think that there's some media that makes you just like keep going for more information, and this was definitely one. And if you want to fall down a Google hole, you should do that too.
I thought about putting that in my Where Are They Now segment and decided against it, but I do think it's important to read about if you are prepared for some heavy things.
Mm-hmm. And the lesson that I learned is sometimes you just need to hear a Ron Dellums in a movie say, "You can be the change," even if you feel very small. And then you cry.
Correct.
And now, to close out this episode, it is time for Sari, who knows nothing, to guess the plot of the next movie. Next time on Cooler Than Homework, we are watching Alley Cat's Strike.
Oh, no. Okay, so my first thought is Newsies, which is also a Disney property. So I'm going to go in that direction. The Alley Cats are some rascally kids. Mm-hmm. They have bikes. And they... I'm just doing Newsies. I got to think of an occupation for kids. Maybe they just like pick up trash. Maybe they... Ooh, they're like normal child size versions of the rescuers where they just like dig through trash cans and find cool things like their junk quarters, and then they have their own internal lives in their own clubhouse. Like, ooh, we're the Alley Cats. We break apart old radios and learn about it. And then at some point, the adults in their lives look at them and they're like, "You need a real hobby. Stop playing with this trash." And the adults, like, the main conflict is the adults come into their clubhouse and bag up all their cool artifacts, being like, "You need to go read a book instead of playing with all this junk," even though they're learning stuff from the junk and hanging out with friends, the Alley Cats. And then the kids, Alley Cats Strike, go on strike from their chores and learn about work movements. Can I have the tagline?
The tagline to this movie is, "The only way to settle the score is to take it to the alley."
Only way to settle the score is to take it to the alley? This sounds like, in this current reality that I've constructed, this makes it sound like the kids and the parents like fight it out in an alley next to the dumpster. But that's not it.
That can be just as close as everything else you've said, though.
That's true. That is as on par with the actual plot of this movie as all of the other words you've spoken.
Yep. Okay, well, this is going to be... Okay, so it's not about the kids and the parents. It's about rival... This is very fictional now. It's one of those magical Disney stories where there are rival troops of, like, Lost Boy-esque junk-hoarding groups. One of them is the Alley Cats. One of them is the Mangy Dogs. And they... They're both trying to build forts out of garbage, but then they're having conflicts over the junk. And so, like, the only way to settle the score is to duke it out in the alley. And so they, like, yell names at each other and they try and sabotage each other's forts. And then the movie ends by them realizing that together they can build a bigger, better fort. The end.
Wow. That is wild. And
Team Mangy Dog.
Team Mangy Dog. Well, find out what actually happened in this movie. Spoiler alert, it's not any of that. Next on Cooler Than Homework. If you are enjoying this podcast, tell your friends, write and review it, all that good stuff. We would love to hear all of your thoughts about The Color of Friendship and just this podcast in general. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up at snarksquad.com/decom, or you can find us on Twitter at Decom Squad. I am at Sweeney Says.
I am at Matthew Gatos.
You can find me at My Name is Marines.
And I'm at C.E. Riley.
This podcast is a Snark Squad production, edited by me, transcribed by Mari, and our theme music is by Stefan Chin.